trees, mountains, a curious kittadoo.
It's time for the Green Desk on 95 BFM.
Welcome back to The Wire. This is Green Desk. Over the weekend, the United Nations High Seas Treaty, also called the Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction Agreement, received its 60th and final required ratification to allow it to take effect from January 2026. The treaty introduces historically significant measures for the protection of the ocean and marine biodiversity, especially in parts of the ocean that do not fall under the jurisdiction of a single nation. After decades of negotiation, 60 countries have now ratified the agreement, with a further 140 countries, including New Zealand, being signatories. Some of the key aspects of the agreement will be the establishment of marine protected areas, the introduction of legal obligations for countries to maintain high environmental standards, and the advancement of critical climate goals, including the ban of bottom trawling and deep sea mining. I spoke with University of Wellington law professor Joanna Mossop more about the significance of this treaty and how effective its legal obligations on an international stage will be, starting with her research interest in international marine law.
Yeah, so the field that I work in is called the law of the sea, which sounds very abstract and strange, but it essentially is the international law that governs how states use the oceans. So I have been following this particular treaty and the negotiations for quite a long time, but I also look at a whole range of other things such as maritime security, dispute settlement, and a whole lot of other ideas.
Yeah, now speaking on this High Seas Treaty, as you understand it, what will this treaty coming into effect mean for international ocean protection?
Well, this treaty has been under negotiation for a very long time. Formal negotiations began in 2018, but in fact, discussions towards the agreement started way back in 2006. The context of the agreement is that it's intended to address gaps in the international law that apply to the high seas and deep seabed, which is why it's called the High Seas Treaty by many. It's not the technical name, but we can refer to it as that. So, and that all goes back to a really important treaty, the Law of the Sea Convention, which was signed in 1982, and that establishes a whole range of different maritime zones, many of which coastal states have rights over living species out to 200 nautical miles, for example, for the exclusive economic zone. And within that zone, we have sort of discretion to figure out how to manage living resources. Beyond national jurisdiction in the high seas and the deep seabed, traditionally, the high seas was governed by freedom of the high seas. But of course, freedoms mean that there is a risk of overexploiting biodiversity. And so there have been a whole lot of different organisations that have been created to manage certain activities on the high seas, such as fishing, shipping and so forth. But overall, they haven't managed to halt the decline in biodiversity in the oceans. So that is why there was some sense that it was a need to address inadequacies in the current law. So under the agreement, it establishes, there's four parts to it essentially. A couple of them are a bit technical and apply to marine genetic resources and biotechnology and the other capacity building. But the aspects that have received the most attention are, first of all, the ability of the convention to create marine protected areas on the high seas, and second of all, to improve environmental impact assessment when countries are considering whether to approve activities on the high seas.
You've talked a little bit about how long it took to negotiate the details of this treaty. Can you talk about what some of the barriers have been for negotiating this High Seas Treaty, and maybe has this been the same case for other similar agreements of multinational protections for the ocean?
Great question. So there are a couple of reasons why it took so long, and they largely relate to existing interests and activities on the high seas. So when a treaty such as this was proposed, and for example, the idea of creating marine protected areas, the question became, what is the intersection between this agreement and other organisations that deal with matters on the high seas already, such as fishing and shipping, as I already mentioned. One of the key concerns that states had in agreeing to negotiate the convention is that they didn't want this new agreement to come in and override existing organisations and existing agreements so that that would undermine the work that, those organisations had been doing. And so it was very important to try to figure out how to fill the gaps that are needed, but not step on the toes, if you like, of institutions that are already governing certain activities. So that was a really tricky aspect of the negotiations. And I guess that reflects the fact that there are states out there that do make a lot of money from activities that could impact on living species. And obviously fishing is one of those, but also other activities like mining and shipping and other things. So the need to get that right was a real reason why the negotiations took so long. The other key reason was because some of the more technical aspects, there was a lot of disagreement, and I'm thinking in particular of the provisions on marine genetic resources. So that took a very long time to resolve as well. But fortunately, we did get there in the end.
Yeah, talking about some of the, I mean, the harms or the some of the key issues that this treaty is looking to resolve around ocean protection or activities like deep sea mining and bottom trawling and that kind of thing. How substantial or effective are the legal obligations that have been defined in this agreement? Will they be enough to kind of address these issues, or will they do enough to protect these ocean areas from such activities?
Yeah, look, first of all, I really have to emphasise that this is a really massive step forward for the law of the sea. And it's put in place processes and protections, particularly around environmental impact assessments, that should hopefully lead to better decision making about activities that are approved in the high seas. The ability to create new marine protected areas is really fantastic, although it's limited in what it can impose on other existing organisations like fisheries bodies. So this is really not a panacea to all of the world's problems, and it's not going to by itself resolve questions about mining and fishing because they are already regulated in other places. But what it does do is it allows for states to have a greater consideration of the marine environment, and it also provides, for example, if a marine protected area is created by this organisation, then states can take those recommendations to the sectoral bodies and argue strongly that the sectoral body should also put in place regulations to protect the environment more than they have. So my answer is it's a qualified yes. It's going to depend on a few things. First of all, how many states sign up that are using the high seas a lot for fishing, etc. And two, how willing states are in these other organisations to amend practices that are already being regulated.
Do you think that there will be any obstacles to New Zealand ratifying this treaty and legislating marine protections domestically?
I really hope not. Certainly the Select Committee, when it reported back on the ratification proposal, was very much in favour of it, and I understand that the Cabinet has approved it. The delay is the need to create implementing legislation. So New Zealand does not ratify international treaties unless they can actually observe it in New Zealand law. And so New Zealand law will have to change, for example, in making sure that New Zealand flagged vessels comply with the rules of marine protected areas, making sure we have the right environmental impact assessment processes in place. So that is why there's a bit of a delay, and I believe that the government is hoping to ratify in the middle of next year. You know, I think there are really good reasons for New Zealand to ratify. I think that we could use it to protect our interests in some ways. So, for example, if someone is planning to do some form of drastic geoengineering project, which is meant to address climate change, but it's right on our doorstep, we now have an ability to have a say for the state with the state that is proposing to do that activity. So New Zealand can, you know, pursue its interests. So I'm really hopeful that the government won't change its mind and will continue ahead with efforts to ratify.
Looking into the future, I suppose, we've got COP30 at the end of this year, and we've got some pretty significant global climate targets that we're hoping to meet within the next few years. What would you say, especially in relation to oceans and marine biodiversity, should countries on an international level be prioritising in the coming years?
So you're right, there's a lot going on at the moment, and it's fantastic that we've got the BBNJ agreement across the line and it'll come into force in January. I think there are a couple of things there. Because the environmental issues are getting very complex, there's a lot of effort that's needed in the climate space, for example, and also the other negotiations that I think is relevant here are the plastics treaty, which has struggled and is not making as much progress as hoped. So there's obviously the need to keep developing rules, but equally important is actually implementing the rules that we have, and so making sure that the BBNJ, the High Seas Agreement, is effective and has institutions that work is going to be really important. So there's a lot of work to do, and however, I think there's a lot of optimism out there that there is an ability for the international community to do better in protecting the ocean.
That was Victoria University Law Professor Joanna Mossop talking with me about the High Seas Treaty.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM.